over the years, there's been a number of very notable prophets. But when you narrow it down to the book of Kings, there's two prophets in general that really stand out. And one of them is Elijah, and one of them is Elisha. But Elisha in particular performs a number of notable miracles that are really quite ranging in what he does, and sometimes even a bit curious. The title of my sermon this afternoon is There No God in Israel? Is there no God in Israel? And the title today is taken from a question that God puts in the mouth of Elijah to ask the king of Israel. And so this afternoon in my sermon, I'd like to look at what happens in the transition from Elijah to Elisha, because there's actually quite a bit of space dedicated to it and some very important lessons that call back on the history of Israel. We'll also look at the many and various miracles that Elisha performs and see if we can find a theme. And then finally, we'll see that despite God's continued presence in the life of Israel, that there was still very little faith among most of the Israelites at that time. So my first point is the title of the sermon, which is point one, is there no God in Israel? Is there no God in Israel? Let's turn over to 2 Kings 1 and verse 1. Now, 2 Kings 1, when we read verse 1, we'll note this. But King Ahab has recently died in battle against the Syrians. And the death of Ahab ends a really, I would say interesting and dark period of Israel's history. But they'll still go on for some time. And so in 2 Kings 1:1, we see that Moab rebelled against Israel after the death of Ahab. Now, Ahab's death actually marks the beginning of the disintegration of the Israelite empire. And they had some pretty sizable territory they had. They were over some of the main trade routes. They were relatively wealthy. But Ahab's death will signal the downward spiral of Israel that will end in captivity. Now, his son Ahaziah sits on the throne, but it's a very short reign. Let's continue reading through verse 2 through verse 4. Now, Ahaziah fell through the lattice of his upper room in Samaria and was injured. So he sent messengers and said to them, go inquire of Beelzebub, the god of Ekron, whether I shall recover from this injury. And I'm sure many of you know, but Beelzebub is literally Lord of the Flies. Verse 3, but the angel of the Lord said to Elijah the Tishbite, arise, go up to meet the messengers of the king of Samaria and say to them, is it because there is no God in Israel that you are going to inquire of Beelzebub, the god of Ekron? Not even the god of, the purported god of Israel. Now therefore, thus says the Lord, you shall not come down from the bed to which you have gone up, but you shall surely die. So Elijah departed. Now, I find in my study of 2 Kings that this is a very central theme for the rest of the story of the kings. And it's kind of a very meta question when you think about it. God is asking the king of Israel and Israel by extension, why they inquire of idols? Why they worship idols? Is it because there's no God in Israel that you do this? And that's even a question we could ask ourselves today in our own very lives. When we make various decisions, and I remember the first sermonette I ever gave in my life was called, Do You Include God in Your Decision Making? Because I'd reflected on numerous things in my life where I just made a decision and hadn't inquired of God. So this is a question that should resonate even to us this very day. Now, we won't read the rest of the story, but this phrase is emphasized three times in the first chapter of 1 Kings chapter 1. Is it because there is no God in Israel that you have turned to idols? In other words, do you seek idols for instruction because there isn't a God in Israel who's capable of looking after you, protecting you, and providing you the answers that you need? So let's continue and pick up the story in the aftermath of Ahaziah's death and turn over to 2 Kings 2 and verse 5. 2 Kings 2, and we'll read verses 5 through 8. Now, back in the latter half of 1 Kings, God had directed Elijah to anoint Elisha to replace him. He was supposed to anoint three people, but one of them was Elisha, He was going to replace him, and now the time had come for Elijah to pass from the scene. So we'll pick up the story here in verse 5. Now the sons of the prophets who were at Jericho came to Elisha and said to him, "Do you know that the Lord will take away your master from over you today?" So he answered, "Yes, I know, keep silent." So a couple things to note here just for the rest of the story is, one, that there's an audience. People are witnessing this. Second, that they're in Jericho and they're going to go cross the Jordan River here in a moment, which is kind of the reverse of what they did coming into the Promised Land. But the key is, this is an area of great historical significance. There's no accident why this is occurring the way it is. Verse 6, then Elijah said to him, "Stay here, please, for the Lord has sent me onto the Jordan." But he said, "As the Lord lives and as your soul lives, I will not leave you." So the two of them went on. And 50 men of the sons of prophets went and stood facing them at a distance while the two of them stood by the Jordan. Now Elijah took his mantle, rolled it up, and struck the water, and it was divided this way and that, so that the two of them crossed over on dry ground. One of the commentaries, I don't know if this is true or not, but they estimated that because the waters got bound up further upstream, created an 18-mile wide section that they could have crossed here. Now, one question we should ask ourselves is, why did Elijah roll up his mantle? Well, in this case, the mantle very clearly is symbolic of Elijah's authority. And so he's using that to split this. In a moment, we'll see this gets passed on. A number of commentaries will bring out that a prophet's mantle symbolizes his authority under God, and certainly does in this situation. Then you might ask yourself, why did Elijah part the water? Why was it necessary for them to get across? Because many times of the season, the water's low enough that you could cross it without too much difficulty. But again, when Israel, led by Joshua, entered the Promised Land the first time, God parted the Jordan River at flood stage so they could enter. Now, why did God do that then? Just note, because we don't have time to turn to it, note two scriptures. Joshua 3:7, and I'll read it to you, and also Joshua 4:14. Joshua 4:14. What Joshua 3:7 says, "And the Lord said to Joshua, 'This day I will begin to exalt you in the sight of all Israel, that they may know that as I was with Moses, so I will be with you.'" That's an important context as we read through and understand what's happening here. Joshua 4:14 also records, on that day, the Lord exalted Joshua. This is as they crossed the Jordan and went across. "The Lord exalted Joshua in the sight of all Israel, and they feared him as they had feared Moses all the days of his life." So you think about ancient Israel, when Moses died, you would understandably kind of wonder what's going to happen next under the next leadership. But this was quite clear. God went out of his way to endorse Joshua in a way that everybody witnessed that was obvious for everyone. And that's what's going on here. God is making it clear to the Israelites that the God that had led them out of Egypt was still there and was the same God that was going to lead them into the Promised Land, whether it was Moses or whether it was Joshua. So let's continue in our story. 2 Kings 2, we'll read verses 9 through 14. "And so it was when they had crossed over that Elijah said to Elisha, 'Ask, what may I do for you before I'm taken away from you?' Elisha said, 'Please let a double portion of your spirit be upon me.'" Now, I don't want to get into that, but a number of commentaries think that what he's really asking for is a double portion, like a double inheritance that a firstborn would get, and not necessarily literally a doubling of his spirit. But don't let me take a position on that. In verse 10, "So he said, 'You have asked a hard thing. Nevertheless, if you see me when I am taken from you, it shall be so for you. But if not, it shall not be so.' Then it happened as they continued on and talked that suddenly a chariot of fire appeared with horses of fire and separated the two of them, and Elijah went up by a whirlwind into heaven. And Elisha saw it, and he cried, 'My father, the chariot of Israel and its horsemen.' So he saw him no more." You know, Ahab and Jezebel represented one of the most apostate periods in the history of Israel, at least up to that point. And they all actively sought to replace the true worship of God with the worship of Baal. This was different than even what Israel had experienced before, where they kind of had the idea, sort of, that they were still worshiping God. This was a replacement by Baal. But again, in their greatest time of need, God sends the greatest prophet of all time in Elijah, a prophet who's pictured along with Moses in the transfiguration of Christ. Now he's passed from the scene. If we were there again, like when Moses died and Joshua came on the scene, when Elijah dramatically gets taken up in a whirlwind and we're left with Elisha, what would we think? Would we wonder where God was? Would we wonder who the new prophet was? In a sense, you know, Elijah's gone. Now what are we supposed to do? Verse 12. And he took hold of his own clothes and tore them into two pieces. It's probably symbolic of him making a clean split with his past. He also took up the mantle of Elijah that had fallen from him, and he went back and stood by the bank of the Jordan. Then he took the mantle of Elijah that had fallen from him, and he struck the water and said, "Where is the Lord God of Elijah?" That even dovetails in with the question that Elijah had asked to Ahaziah. And when he had also struck the water, it was divided this way and that, and Elisha crossed over. So here we have a scene where the mantle, in front of many witnesses, is passed, quite literally, from Elijah to Elisha. Elijah did pass from the scene, but God was leaving a prophet with them, one that was at least equal in his capability of what God had done through Elijah. So the question is, where is the Lord God of Elijah? Still here. Still supporting his prophets, still supporting his nation and his people. So he crosses the Jordan in the same way that he and Elijah had crossed over the other side, showing that God was with his prophet. The same power was still there. This again aligns perfectly with the theme of, is it because there is no God in Israel? Through the dramatic signs shown here and the callback to Moses and Joshua, God is clearly showing that he is still the God in Israel and that he may be inquired of. Which takes us into the second point. Point number two is the manifold miracles of Elijah. The manifold miracles of Elijah. Manifold is M-A-N-I-F-O-L-D. Now, I like the word manifold because of its meaning. Manifold means many and various. So the implication is here, the many and various miracles of Elijah. Another definition of the word is having many different forms or elements. And in a sense, that's kind of our first key to the various miracles that Elisha performs, is that they are indeed many and various. Why? Let's turn to 2 Kings 2 and verse 19. Or just continue on, actually. In 2 Kings 2 and verse 19. Let's look at a couple of miracles that transpire in the immediate aftermath of the dramatic crossing of the Jordan, the clear transition to Elisha, and that he has power at least equivalent to Elijah. 2 Kings 2 and verse 19. Then the men of the city said to Elisha, "Please notice, the situation of this city is pleasant, as my Lord sees, but the water is bad and the ground is barren." Now, they're in the area of Jericho. And that's by far the most likely city that they have in mind here. Now, Jericho had been rebuilt during the reign of Ahab with much difficulty. But as you'll recall, Jericho had cursed the one who rebuilt Jericho. And this seems to be the case here, that there still is a curse lingering over Jericho. But continuing on in verse 20, "And he said, 'Bring me a new bowl and put salt into it.' So they brought it to him. Then he went out to the source of the water and cast in the salt there and said, 'Thus says the Lord, I have healed this water. From it there shall be no more death or barrenness.' So the water remains healed to this day according to the word of Elisha, which he spoke." So, not explicitly said so, but I think that there's an implication of this. In this incident, we see that Elisha removed the curse from Jericho that Joshua had put on it and healed the waters and the land around it. And now it could be a productive area again. Now let's say you have some money difficulties. Let's read 2 Kings. Let's move down to 2 Kings chapter 4 and verse 1. So restoration of land that it could now be fertile and worked. Restoration of spoiled water that could now be used. 4 and verses 1 through 7. Now right off the top here, it's always notable to me when there's widows involved, because there's a theme that seems to run with the widows throughout the Bible, particularly in the Old Testament, but not only there. But 2 Kings 4 and verse 1. "A certain woman of the wives of the sons of the prophets cried out to Elisha, saying, 'Your servant, my husband, is dead, and you know that your servant feared the Lord, and the creditor is coming to take my two sons to be his slaves.'" Now, actually, more than just a few commentaries felt like that this is most probably, and this is even a Jewish tradition, that the widow here, her husband was Obadiah. And Obadiah was working under Ahab, and he was the man that protected the true prophets of God in the caves and protected them. And so one of the theories is that he'd gone into debt feeding them and taking care of. That's just a theory. But her call, referring to him as a man that feared God in this context, kind of lends some credibility to it. But either way, her husband's died. She has a tremendous amount of debt she can't pay, and the creditors are coming. Now, Elisha's response here is something along the lines of, yes, that is the way it is, so what can I do for you? Like, in other words, he can't change that's going to happen. That's how the law is configured. Verse 2, so Elisha said to her, what shall I do for you? That's his answer. I can't change that. Tell me, what do you have in the house? And she said, your maidservant has nothing in the house but a jar of oil. So this is a debt regulation that he can't do anything about. But he says, maybe I can help you in a different way. Verse 3, then he said, go borrow vessels from everywhere, from all your neighbors. Empty vessels, do not gather just a few. See, that's where I would fail in this mission. I would think like five was not just a few. But she seems to do a good job with it here. And then he said, go borrow vessels, not just a few. And when you have come in, you shall shut the door behind you and your sons, then pour it into all the vessels and set aside the full ones. So he went from him and shut the door behind her and her sons who brought the vessels to her, and she poured it out. Now it came to pass when the vessels were full that she said to her son, bring me another vessel. And he said to her, there is not another vessel. So the oil ceased. And then she came and told the man of God, and he said, go sell the oil and pay your debt, and your sons live on the rest. So in my opinion, it's not hard to feel the callback to when Elijah stayed with the Sidonian widow. And they had a similar situation where they were in a severe famine. And God made the oil last as long as it needed to until they were out of the famine. In this case, the oil lasted as long as the vessels they had, but resolved her problem. Now, the next story. In some ways, this woman has a very opposite problem of what this widow had. And we'll just continue on in 2 Kings 4 and read verses 8 through 10. Now, it happened one day that Elisha went to Shunem, where there was a notable woman, and she persuaded him to eat some of the food. So it was, as often as he passed by, he would turn in and there to eat some food. And she said to her husband, look now, I know that this is a holy man of God who passes by us regularly. Please let us make a small upper room on the wall, and let us put a bed for him there, and a table and a chair and a lampstand. So it will be, whenever he comes to us, he can turn in there. So a couple things to note about this. This phrase calling her a notable woman, because that doesn't really give us a lot. Some of the other translations have it a woman of substance, or a great woman, or a prosperous woman. And all those things seem to define her somewhat. We could view, unlike the previous woman who had no money, had a tremendous financial issue, she is in a good position. She is prosperous, she's of some note, and she's relatively content with what she has. But she shows her hospitality to Elisha and Gehazi when he travels with them, passes through the area frequently on what appears to be a circuit, and she recognizes, maybe one of the few in some ways, that Elisha is a holy man of God. And so she wants to support him and provide for him while he's on his circuit when he passes through the area. In verse 14, so he said, what then is to be done for her? And Gehazi asked, because he asked what can be done for her, and she turns him down on some of the other things. And Gehazi answered, actually, she has no son, and her husband is old. So he said, call her. When he had called her, she stood in the doorway. Then he said, about this time next year, you shall embrace a son. And she said, no, my Lord, man of God, do not lie to your maidservant. So Elisha has really appreciated her concern and care for them. He offered to speak to the king for her or to the court. She says, no, I don't need any of those things. I live a life of security. I live a life amongst my people. I don't need anything like that. But she doesn't have a son. And so Elisha says, you'll have one in about a year. And her indication and her response is entirely like she didn't dare to have a hope like that. This is beyond what she could have hoped for. But verse 17, the woman conceived and bore a son when the appointed time had come, of which Elisha had told her. And the child grew. Now when it happened one day that when he went out to his father, to the reapers, that he said to his father, my head, my head. So here she conceives and bears a child, grows up. You could estimate maybe 4 or 5 seems to be about the right age. And he's carried to his mother after his head hurts and he dies in her lap. It's interesting because the same thing happened to the Sidonian widow that sheltered Elijah. And you wonder why these things happen. But they're recorded for our admonition because of they didn't change their what they were doing or their behavior. The Sidonian widow continues to support Elijah. She continues to support Elisha and has faith that he can do something about it because she believes that there is a God in Israel. And God very likely arranged this situation so that he could manifest this miracle. Verse 21, now when she came to the man of God at the hill, she caught him. We're skipping over quite a bit. Sorry, okay. We're going to read 2 Kings 4, 27 and 28. Just not have time to go through the whole story. Now when she came to the man of God at the hill, she caught him by the feet, but Gehazi came near to push her away. But the man of God said, let her alone, for her soul is in deep distress, and the Lord has hidden it from me and has not told me. Now, a little note there about kind of Gehazi's reaction, because he turns out to not be such a great guy. So she said, did I ask for a son, my Lord? Did I say, do not deceive me? It's interesting that upon reaching Elisha, she doesn't say what's wrong. She says how she feels about it, which is kind of fascinating. One commentary says she was so heartbroken at her son's death, she felt as if it would have been better if he had never been born. But she held a steadfast belief that Elisha, through God, was able to restore her son's life. And so come down to verse 32. 2 Kings 4 and verse 32. She won't leave his side. Elisha sends Gehazi on ahead, but he can't do anything. Verse 32. When Elisha came into the house, there was the child lying dead on his bed. He went in, therefore, shut the door behind the two of them and prayed to the Lord. And he went up and lay on the child and put his mouth on his mouth, his eyes on his hands, and his hands on his hands. And he stretched himself out on the child, and the flesh of the child became warm. He returned and walked back and forth in the house and again went up and stretched himself out on him. Then the child sneezed 7 times, and the child opened his eyes. And he called Gehazi and said, call the Shunammite woman. So he called her, and when she came in, he said, pick up your son. So she went in, fell at his feet, and bowed to the ground, and she picked up her son and went out. It's fascinating to me that before she picks up her son, she acknowledges the miracle that God performed through Elisha. Now, this was a very difficult event that it could. There's no, when you read through Elisha's life and the various miracles, nothing seemed to be as difficult as this one. And I don't really have a good explanation for why. But this story is just fascinating to me on several levels, especially because we come back to the story of her, if we have time. Point number 3, there was very little faith in Israel. Point 3, there was very little faith in Israel. Let's go down to 2 Kings 5 and start in verse 1, and we'll read through verse 4. Actually, we'll read through verse 10. We'll break it up. 2 Kings 5 and verses 1 through 10. So, there's this ongoing theme, unfortunately, through Israel, not just in the time of the judges, of course, but also in the time of the kings. There's individuals here and there that are doing the right thing. The nation in general was doing better at some times than other. But there was this ongoing lack of faith that led Israel to continually slide into idolatry. And somewhat ironically, at times, you felt like there was more faith outside of Israel about the God of Israel than inside. This is an example. 2 Kings 5 and verse 1. Now Naaman, commander of the army of the king of Syria, was a great, honorable man in the eyes of his master, because by him the Lord had given victory to Syria. He was also a mighty man of valor, but a leper. And the Syrians had gone out on raids and had brought back captive a young girl in the land of Israel. She waited on Naaman's wife. Then she said to her mistress, if only my master were with the prophet who is in Samaria, for he would heal him of his leprosy. And Naaman went in and told his master, saying, "Thus and thus said the girl, who is from the land of Israel." Now, this is not important, but the legend is that Naaman is the one who actually killed Ahab when he was finally defeated by the Syrians. There's not really a lot to go on here with this girl, but the treatment was good enough of her that she had a fondness for at least Naaman's wife, but also for Naaman, apparently, because she makes the suggestion. Continuing on in verse 5, "Then the king of Syria said, 'Go now, and I will send a letter to the king of Israel.' So he departed and took with him 10 talents of silver, 6,000 shekels of gold, and 10 changes of clothing." Now, we read this, and we know how this story turns out, but just think about that for a moment. Somebody who's not an Israelite is told that there's a prophet in Israel that could heal him, goes to the king, repeats the same thing. The king says, "Yeah, you're probably right. And take some things. You have my leave. Make sure you take something with him to honor him in payment in some way." And he departs on not an inconsiderable journey to go down and find out if the king of Israel, through Elisha, can heal him, or the God of Israel, sorry. Verse 6, "Then he brought the letter to the king of Israel, which said, 'Now be advised, when this letter comes to you, that I have sent Naaman, my servant, to you, that you may heal him of his leprosy.'" Notice the reaction. "And it happened when the king of Israel read the letter that he tore his clothes and said, 'Am I God to kill and make alive, that this man sends a man to me to heal him of his leprosy? Therefore, please consider and see how he seeks a quarrel with me.'" A very ironic response, especially in light of the non-Israelite response. Verse 8, "So it was when Elisha, the man of God, heard that the king of Israel had torn his clothes, that he sent to the king, saying, 'Why have you torn your clothes? Please let him come to me, and he shall know that there is a prophet in Israel.'" Doesn't this call back again to the first question God had Elijah ask of Ahaziah? Is it because there's no God in Israel? And it's interesting. Elisha had to hear of it secondhand. It's not like the king of Israel said, "Somebody find Elisha." He didn't know what to do. Elisha heard it through the grapevine and came in and said, "Send him to me. I'll take care of it." Naaman, by contrast, has more faith. Verse 9, "Then Naaman went out with his horses and chariot, and he stood at the door of Elisha's house. And Elisha sent a messenger to him, saying, 'Go and wash in the Jordan 7 times, and your flesh shall be restored to you, and you shall be clean.'" Now, probably it's understandable that if you're Naaman and you're a mighty man and the prophet doesn't even bother to come out and see you but sends a messenger and tells you to wash in your dirty little river, the response wasn't good, but we don't have time to go through that. Naaman is initially disgruntled by what Elisha tells him to do. But it's interesting. It's his servants, those attending to him, that convince him that, no, why don't you go through it? If he'd asked you to do something dramatic, you'd have done it. Why not something this simple? So once again, you kind of wonder about the mindset of these people, that they had some level of belief that this might work. Very contrary to the general attitude in Israel at that time. Now, he's healed, but Gehaziah can't handle turning down free stuff. Verse 20. Verse 14, "So he went down and dipped 7 times in the Jordan, according to the saying of the man of God, and his flesh was restored like the flesh of a little child, and he was clean. And he returned to the man of God, he and all his aides, and he came and stood before him, and he said, 'Indeed, now,'" what's his response? "'I know that there is no God in all the earth except in Israel.'" And everybody seemed to know it but the Israelites. "'Now, therefore, please take a gift from your servant.' But he said, 'As the Lord lives, before whom I stand, I will receive nothing.' And he urged him to take it, but he refused." So, Gehaziah, as I said, he can't let it go. Verse 20. We'll skip down to verse 20, and we'll read through verse 22. "But Gehaziah, the servant of Elisha, the man of God, said, 'Look, my master has spared Naaman the Syrian, while not receiving from his hand what he brought. But as the Lord lives, I will run after him and take something from him.' So Gehaziah pursued Naaman. When Naaman saw him running after him, he got down from the chariot to meet him, and he said, 'Is all well?' And he said, 'All is well. My master has sent me, saying, Indeed, just now 2 young men of the sons of the prophets have come to me from the mountains of Ephraim. Please give them a talent of silver and 2 changes of garments.'" You know, here Gehazi displays an appalling lack of character in this lie, and actually dragging poor Elisha's name into it as if it was Elisha who had asked for this. Verse 25. Now he went and stood before his master, Elisha, and said to him, "Where did you go, Gehazi?" And he said, "Your servant did not go anywhere." Then he said to him, "Did not my heart go with you when the man turned back from his chariot to meet you?" And this, I've been thinking about this response right here for the last month. Is it time to receive money and to receive clothing, olive groves and vineyards, sheep and oxen, male and female servants? Is this the time we look for our great reward? Therefore, the leprosy of Naaman shall cling to you and your descendants forever. And he went out from his presence leprous, as white as snow. You know, like I said, Elisha's response here really hit me and made me think about it. And think about what we're all doing here right now. Why are we called now? Mr. Armstrong said it was to do the work. That's our primary mission and commission. And yes, we have to have a job. And yes, we have other things we do in our lives. But where's our balance? Where are our priorities? There's a lot packed in there with what he said. You know, Gehazi, despite having a front row seat to one of the greatest prophets of all time, not only witnessing his miracles, but in some sense even being a part of them, he still didn't get it. He didn't understand their mission and what they were doing. You know, Mr. Weston mentioned in his sermon recently, 5 Lessons from the Rebellion. Despite numerous miracles, they didn't really have a significant impact on most of the people. And Gehazi, being right there and seeing it all, it still went right over his head. You might note Matthew 10, verses 7 and 8. We won't turn there. I'll just read it to you. Matthew 10, verses 7 and 8. "And as you go, preach, saying, 'The kingdom of heaven is at hand.' Heal the sick, cleanse the lepers, raise the dead, cast out demons. Freely you have received, freely give." You know, the commission that God gave to his church and the miracles he allowed his disciples and the apostles to perform showed God's supremacy over every element that there is, over physical life, over the spiritual realm, over even life and death. And Elisha's various miracles are showing that same thing. There's no charge for our services. Our reward is in the future, and Gehazi did not understand it. Now let's return back to the Shunammite who was the notable woman who had lived a comfortable life. Let's turn to 2 Kings 8 and verse 1. You know, when we left off with her story, she had been rewarded by Elisha for her service to him. She was given a son when she was barren, and even at his death, he was restored to life by God through Elisha. And she at that time was in a very secure position. That's the entire sense of it. And she couldn't, I don't want to put too much into her, but when we live a very secure life, it's difficult to imagine that life being upended and changing. And all of a sudden your circumstances are very different. And something you didn't need before, like a word with the king, you might now. 2 Kings 8 and verse 1. "Then Elisha spoke to the woman whose son he had restored to her life, saying, 'Arise and go, you and your household, and stay wherever you can, for the Lord has called for a famine. And furthermore, it will come upon the land for 7 years.' So the woman arose and did according to the saying of the man of God. And she went with her household and dwelt in the land of the Philistines for 7 years." All of a sudden, everything in her life changed. She was very comfortable. But because Israel was a very corrupt nation at that time, with a real lack of faith in God, who was right there showing miracles, showing that from one prophet to another, from one leader to another, the God of Israel was still there. The Syrians seemed to recognize that was the case. And you know, famine and drought are always key indicators for Israel's condition, because so much of their obedience was tied to that. Now there's a pretty good indication here that her husband, since we last read about her, had died. As in the previous description, he was described as very old, and he's not mentioned here. So it's quite possible that she's now a widow. She suddenly had to leave her territory to avoid a famine. To her credit, she doesn't question it. She does exactly what Elisha tells her to, but she comes back. Verse 3. And it came to pass at the end of 7 years that the woman returned from the land of the Philistines, and she went to make an appeal to the king for her house and for her land. Then the king talked with Gehazi. Not all these stories are in order, it would appear. The servant of the man of God, saying, tell me, please, all the great things Elisha has done. So he's casually talking to the king. The king's heard all these things about Elisha. Tell me about some of these miracles. Now it happened as he was telling the king how he had restored the dead to life, that there was the woman whose son he had restored to life, appealing to the king for her house and for her land. And Gehazi said, my lord, O king, this is the woman, and this is her son whom Elisha restored to her life. And when the king asked the woman, she told him. So the king appointed a certain officer for her, saying, restore all that was hers and all her proceeds of the field from the day that she left the land until now. You know, her steadfast faith that Elisha was a man of God and that there was a God in Israel and you could call upon him and he would help you in your time of need seemed to be deeply baked into her. And despite having left for 7 years, not only was all her property restored by the king, really because of Elisha's intervention in a sense, even the back profits were restored to her. You know, my back of the envelope math has Elisha performing at least 14 miracles of various sorts in one form or another. The moment that Elijah's mantle was passed to him, Elisha performed a miracle that was on par with Moses, Joshua, and Elijah by parting the rivers. Elisha performed miracles that ranges from removing an ancient curse, restoring barren land and defiled water, to providing oil for a widow to pay her debts, bringing life to a barren womb and restoring the life of the same child, redeeming a pot of death that was poisoned and saving everyone's life, and feeding 100 men, telling the king of Israel every move his enemies are making, telling a wicked king of Israel that a severe famine would come but would switch to excess food in one day, restoration of property and healing leprosy, and yes, even floating an iron axe head when necessary. God, through his servant Elisha, showed Israel that not only was there a God in Israel, but that there was nothing in the physical or spiritual realm that God did not have power over, even life and death. Just because Elijah was passing from the scene didn't mean that God wasn't still there. And he repeats this, he reinforces this repeatedly through these various miracles. If we have faith that God is with us and we believe in him and we call on him, he will help us. Now, sometimes the answer is no, and that requires its own faith. But we have a God we can call on that if he needs to, there's nothing that his arm is too short that he can't save us from. But if we remember why we are called, keep our priorities straight, and stay focused on our mission, then our reward will be greater than anything we could possibly acquire in this lifetime.